Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the 40K Fireside Podcast. I'm David Gaylor, and I'm joined by my good friend, Vic Vijay. Together, we discuss 40K and the meta from our perspective, along with events we've recently been to and those that have got coming up. So come on down to the fireside and listen. All right, everyone. It's still sunny outside. 6:30 a.m. here, getting up, doing back-to-back episodes. Really excited for the WTC. This is episode 32. We're going to be chatting about the WTC singles. Well, we'll be chatting about a lot of topics, probably wherever we want to go. And I'm actually really excited to have my guest here, Mr. Liam Hackett, the one and only, the force from down under, I think he's probably supposed to be called. Liam, you're not going to know that I'm going to do this, but your name, you know, when you go and play tournaments with your teammates and what like that, or you're going to meet up with other top players at the tournament scene, Liam's name does come up every once in a while when the mention of who do you think X player rates or however X player is good. Liam's name is always up there, I will tell you, as everyone thinks Liam is extremely good. So I've no doubt he's an absolute machine. Champions of the WTC last year, champion of the singles event last year, top sportsmanship as well. What else do you want in a 40K player? He's also a doctor, to my best knowledge, so seems like an all-around good bloke, and I've been chatting to him a little bit before the show, so he seems like a really nice guy. Liam, welcome to the show. It's really
pleasant. Thanks very much. I've managed to get you fooled already.
That's how I do my guests. I pamper them up, and then I bring them back down later in the episode.
Butter them up before you get started. That makes sense.
Yeah. So today we're going to be chatting about the WTC singles event. Now, this is a eight-round event that happens a couple of days before the WTC. It's an open event, and I think to date it's got about 297 players involved in it. So a few more players than the team event, but I think a lot of people from the team event don't play the singles event for a couple of reasons, right? They don't want to play it because it's a bit of a marathon effort to play the singles into the teams. And then if you're playing the team event, you don't want to get scouted. You don't want your list doesn't want to get seen. But the advantage is that it's really good practice, I think. You know, you get 8 rounds on the terrain format in the building, playing maybe a list that's like adjacent to what you're playing. Or, you know, even if you're playing something totally different, I'm playing something totally different for singles than I am for the team event. But that's the format. Liam, how did you find it last year? Did you the marathon effort last year as well. You did the singles into the teams. Was it as bad as you, like, as it seems on paper, playing, I don't know, 14 odd games, or was it just exciting all the way through?
Well, so when you say, was it as bad as it seems on paper, that the answer is profoundly worse, but also better. So obviously playing 14 plus games of 40K in the span of about 6 days is the reason that in some of the photos after that event, I looked like a husk. I was also very drunk in most of those photos, but the general point is that I think that it's a marathon effort, as you said, but it really depends what you're trying to get out of it. So for me, when I first went to the WTC, that was the longest and furthest that I'd ever traveled for a 40K event. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make sure that I wasn't hitting round one of teams, with those nerves, to be honest. I actually really like playing the War Master singles as a bit of an icebreaker, to be perfectly honest, because I find singles events generally relaxing. Mm-hmm. And sort of you don't have that added pressure. And so it meant that going into teams, I was already limbered up, ready to go for the teams event. And obviously, I think it suits me as a player, but it's not for everyone, right? Mm. You know, for quite a lot of people, you need to conserve that energy, have that sort of gamer's endurance to give the team's event your 110%. Mm-hmm. And you also rightfully said that you don't want to play singles, presumably, with the same list that you take to teams, especially if it's a unique take on a faction or a list or has potential value in pairings. And so... Yes. Australia, just for anyone listening, has a blanket rule that's been in place for a number of years and remains. I'm the captain of the Australian team this year and remains in place this year, where nobody is to play their team's list for singles, with some minor exceptions. If you're playing like Imperial Knights, for example, you know, the battle cannon you put on your Crusader is not exactly going to be the unique take that wins the WTC, but in general, most of the singles lists are not the team's army, and that's why my singles list is very bad.
Yes, sorry, not yes to your singles list is very bad, because I'm gonna go into that in a second. But yes, I totally agree. I think there's a couple of different types of players that would gravitate towards that. But let me backtrack first. You are also right in that obviously singles lists fundamentally, I guess. One difference between us starkly probably is that I'm not a solo only singles player. I've been playing team events a little bit, but I guess most of my time I've been playing singles, and you know, the playing into an open field where you should play against XYZ is completely different to playing teams where you can go, I don't have to play against XYZ, you know, play me against this. Your list design and what you can bring in, the availability of what is considered viable to win a big tournament with, is completely different. So that's the huge part about difference between singles and teams. But I think you touched on a good point, which is it's not for everyone, which I think it kind of just comes down to what type of player you are. I'm actually a lot like you when you mentioned that it's nice to get a few rounds in and just get the nerves off. You kind of go into the flow of things. I know I practice pretty much only on TTS, which means I don't believe Australia practice on TTS very much. You guys are more real life playing, correct me if I'm wrong.
David, for the record, I've stolen a computer from the Queensland government for the purposes of recording this podcast. I do everything on my phone, so the odds of me actually playing TTS are zero.
I love it. It's so good. but if you're, that's great. If you're like me, then you kind of will like rub off the, get, you know, like get the dust off a little bit, you know, get a few rounds in you. It's kind of like, you know, warming up the engine, so to speak. So I'm a big fan of playing the singles as well. So did you have a chance to go through the singles players list? Did you? So I guess, you know, from last year, I think, I don't know how many people were in the tournament last year, but I get the impression it's quite a bit larger this year, which is great to see.
Yeah.
A lot of people are playing it.
It's quite a bit larger. Back to your earlier question, if I've had a look at the singles lists, no. Mm-hmm. I haven't looked at any of them. And the main reason for that from my perspective is that, you know, I'm very much a team's play, like for 40k team events, they're very big. Sure. In Australia, and there's quite a lot of teams events, and for me that's my focus through and through. Mm-hmm. My attitude to War Masters is that all of the time that I have available to me left, I will do zero prep games.
Mm. Yeah.
With my War Masters lists, the list that I have submitted I have never played. Mm-hmm. Will be using, hopefully, assuming I don't play like you round one of War Masters, I will be using those games as sort of the momentum building, fingers crossed, and also realizing that the army does not function in any capacity. I haven't looked at the lists, but I have obviously spent a prodigious amount of hours looking at the WTC teams lists.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the flow over into War Masters.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just going to quickly cover your list that you are playing, the garbage list, as you would so to say.
Hey, they said it was garbage last year too, and it's almost the same army. So
I will give you a caveat. Necrons is one of the armies that I've played the most of in 10th edition, actually. So when I saw your teams list as well, I had a lot of questions as well. And I guess you could say, you've probably seen our Necron list, and that's kind of a reflection of where my head's at. So I love WTC because you get to see it, you know, it's a battle of the ideas, and it's a whole month has passed basically of El Silencio silence to date. So it's been so good to be like, oh, this player played this or something. And actually, because I played Necron so much, Liam, one of your lists is one of the first I looked at because you played Necrons last year as well. But let's go over the singles list, because this one's quite good. You've got Triple Chronomancer, you've got a Nightbringer, you've got the Transcendent Satan with the 4-up Feel No Pain. Some people are on this, some people don't like it. I've noticed that Poland doesn't play the Transcendent Satan, which is really interesting. Four units of 10 Necron Warriors, not even the 20s, but that matches four Ghost Arcs. So,
oh yeah,
four now units of 10 Warriors, four Ghost Arcs, Canoptic Reanimator, a couple of Satan, and Catacomb Command Barge, of course. And when I look at this list, I thought, Liam wants to practice the fundamentals of Necrons when he's playing the playing the singles event here, because when I played Necrons, I actually found that there was an incredibly high skill cap playing an army like this. I really loved the minutiae that you could optimize around saves, around maths, around reanimation positioning, and everything like that. You know, the army doesn't have a lot of output, I would say, me personally, but I really enjoyed, and I thought the warrior aspect to the list was actually the most powerful list. So when I saw your WTC teams list, which is quite a bit different from this, but sort of thematically the similar, you're one of the only people playing a warrior brick as well, or two warrior bricks in this case. I thought we've sort of come to the same conclusion in that sense, that I think that the warriors are the quickest way to hit the game. So regardless of that, are you going to be taking cleanse and teleport home at every single game in the singles or not?
Well, look, the thing is that, David, I'm a sadist. I really like suffering. And so mm-hmm. I think I'm going to, depending on who and what I'm playing against, I might kind of branch out and take, like, I might actually do some behind enemy lines for a bit of a meme. Every now and then, I might just go play tactical because I like CP and failure is fun. Look, it can probably do a bunch of different things. So you touched on an interesting point before, that you looked at my list and your first thought was that Liam wants to practice the fundamentals. That's part of it, sure. Being fully honest, the other part of it is that there's two parts to this, which, you know, sounds a bit bad, but the first part was because I won the War Master event last year with four ghost arcs filled with warriors. I felt that if I even did mildly well again, the internet would break.
That's sweet.
And I thought that would be very funny. I also thought that GW's stocks of ghost arcs would be dwindled very, very quickly, which I thought would just be a hilarious outcome overall. The second thing is that the part of 10th edition, there's a long list here, which I don't want to deviate in too much, but the part of 10th edition that I like the least is that there's no longer a disembark from Hull style mechanic.
Yes.
For skimmers of any description.
Yep.
And so I agree with most people's assertion that that's a really ridiculous rule set. And so I just kind of wanted to see if it could be done. Mm. I just kind of wanted to see if, oh, look, I'm going to play an all skimmer army and I'm going to see how this goes.
Yeah, we can deviate on that too, because that's fine. I personally think this skimmer rule or no hull rule is the stupidest thing I've heard. And actually, if the hull rule was in play, I would personally opt for playing a ghost arc myself. And that was one of the defining points why I didn't play a ghost arc, was because of the skimmer-based rule on WTC. Yeah. I felt that was annoying. Like, I can really understand in your list. By the way, guys, just a caveat, I'm trying not to talk about Liam's team list because Liam doesn't want to chat about his team list because he's a serious player, unlike me, you know, we just seed four, go all day, baby. But which is perfectly understandable. But yeah, I kind of opted for the no ghost type only because the skimmer rule, if the hull rule wasn't in place, I'd be all for it. So it's amazing how something like that can change things so much. You know, you're just talking about 3 inches of coherency, so to speak, or something like that. But it's annoying because the ghost arc is obviously an enormous model with one tiny base in the middle, so it's the most egregious example of that.
Yeah, it is, and it's kind of why I'm doing it. I mean, it's a bit of a double-edged sword with the way WTC terrain works. With for those who haven't seen it, all of the ruins have 12-inch by 6-inch bases. Mm-hmm. The measure everything to base rules has some interesting applications when it comes to being in wholly within or partially within terrain.
Yes.
And so, yeah, the ghost arcs are big small. They're big small. Yep. I don't really know how else to word that. Very weird. It's a very, yes, very weird dynamic.
Yes, what Liam's alluding to here is that you can overhang half of your model onto the terrain whilst the skimmer base is not on the terrain, so it's not technically on the terrain, much like the Night Spinner can also do, or the Wave,
yeah,
for example, as well.
Preposterous.
Very bizarre, yeah. I've just looked and I've just checked. It looks like the entire of Team Australia is playing the War Masters Team Singles. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
No, so We have some, everyone might have a ticket. It's kind of a general rule that we all kind of buy a ticket, but I encourage, we have five coaches this year, which is really, really awesome to see. And all five of the coaches will be playing the War Master event. I encourage them wholeheartedly to do that.
Sure.
But some of the players find they get a bit burnt out if they do both. So some of the players won't be.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if you're, because, you know, obviously, you know, Team Australia is completely focused on the team's event, as they should, Romania champions from last year. You know, maybe you come up to the War Masters, play a couple of rounds for one day, and then, you know, take the rest of the days off, right? Who cares, you know? You're there for the team event primarily as well, right? That's awesome.
Exactly. That, the team event is definitely the focus. One thing that we've kind of noticed, I think, is a bit of a psychology difference. In Australian events, it's considered quite rude to drop from an event. It's actually quite frowned upon. And so in general, this is probably the one exception to that rule where I would encourage players who want to conserve their energy to drop. And it's kind of because in previous years, we've noticed perhaps cultural and community differences mean that it's less frowned upon, I think, is a fair statement. Whereas, for example, if you did that at Uprising Adelaide, for example, in Australia, you'd be mocked.
Yeah, I think that's a... And I've been mocked for dropping from a tournament, even over here, actually, as well. And I think it's sort of due to the tournament size, so to speak, isn't it, really? You know, or, you know, if you have a special... Well, coming from New Zealand as well, you know, smaller communities, you know, has a larger impact if you drop, particularly as well, or seen as a sign of weakness, so to speak. It's like, oh, you know, he dropped, he doesn't want to play, you know, or something like that. So it's a, I think that's all of that is a part of transitioning into a larger, more competitive, mature game. Hopefully, I think that will change in Warhammer. And look, sometimes it's good to drop because you've got family reasons or something like that on. Happened for me recently at a tournament. And if you got, you know, at the end of the day, Warhammer is just a board game, isn't it? You know, you got life's a bit more important than Warhammer.
Or you could just be angry. Yeah. You know, like both of them are options. Like,
it's true. There's nothing wrong with that. So, and of course, if you're traveling all the way from Australia or New Zealand, it's a great opportunity to maybe come early to Europe, maybe do a little bit of a holiday, and then maximize your time playing Warhammer when you get there, right? Because, you know, it's a big investment coming over from either of these countries. So you might as well get as much Warhammer as possible. That's the way I look at it. We have four people from New Zealand playing the singles event. I encouraged, as a seed four team, I encouraged everyone to go and play the singles event out of my own sadism as well. But I think we're also playing our... I've just realized someone has listed Team New Zealand as their team, but they're actually not on our team. That's great. Jamie Beaton, you shouldn't be playing for Team New Zealand in the singles. But I've encouraged them to use their team events because I think it would be a great opportunity, especially for players who don't have exposure or might be their first time at WTC, to play the exact list they're playing on the terrain against European opponents who, you know, they might be playing against in the next coming days, just to fully adjust as much as possible. But I guess experts like Australia probably don't need to be using that time of initiation period, so to speak, do you?
Yeah, and you know, David, I mean, to be blunt as well, the fact that you did want to ask questions about it, and if he listens to this, the fact that Alex Taus has been messaging me a number of questions asking specifically what that fucking flair in my list does means that there is a reason I shouldn't play my team's army in singles, right? Because those questions are, you know, there's no reason to give out free answers.
Yeah, exactly. And Teams has a lot of tech in there as well. So, Liam, if you manage to break the internet and you know, win with I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh. Win with 40 warriors and 4 ghost arcs. You know, what is, I guess that is obviously success in one sphere, but what does success look like for the tournament in you otherwise? Is it just having a winning record with a list like this, or is it just, you know, to learn more than anything, regardless of record?
Boy, what does success look like? That is a multi-layered question, David.
I asked good ones on here.
Yeah, that's fair. Look, the reality is that last year I was very fortunate and I did win the War Master Singles, and Australia won the teams event, and I got the highest BP overall at the event, and we won best sport. And so from my perspective, it's kind of about par. We're kind of trying to do as good as previously, because unfortunately there's very limited room for improvement in terms of like doing better in subsequent years.
Yes.
Success for me, I think, I think that as a person who's played exactly zero singles events in 10th edition, success for me would be winning against all bar a few key things.
Mm-hmm.
But also one thing that was very valuable for me last year, to be honest, was I dropped everything that was Canop Tech from my team's army and took all the Ghost Arcs back then as well. Four Ghost Arcs filled with warriors. You're seeing a theme here. And what playing that taught me was how good the Canop Tech stuff was. it made me lust very powerfully for 27 Scarabs.
Yeah.
And so when I started playing my team's list, it made me feel like unstoppable.
Yes.
And there's some kind of psychology element there for me, sort of, for example, I'm playing a Necron army for singles that has no Cryptothralls in it, for God's sake. So as soon as I start playing my team's list again, and I go, oh, that's right, Cryptothralls are incredible. And I think that psychologically for me would probably be the biggest success. Me going into teams knowing that the list that I'm taking is what I know it to be.
Mm, yeah, fantastic. It's a really interesting take on things. It's so interesting to see how focused, I guess, which is perhaps is a little bit of ignorance on my side or naivety, people are on the teams event as well. Because I think, for me, I've been, I guess you could say I'm in the complete opposite boat, right? I have UK team over here. We have a singles team. And then we have Team New Zealand, which is our first year coming to WTC. For me, I'm just as excited to play the War Masters singles as I am the deep
totally
the
team respect main that, event. Yeah.
And so I guess a lot of my focus has probably also been on focusing on the singles event as well, or getting practice with my army. I'm playing Eldari, so trying to put my best foot forward to win the event. What do you see as sort of, I guess, apart from the obvious two, GSC and Eldari, what do you see as the kind of main hitters on the WTC format for singles specifically?
Well, without being overly coy, it's kind of like a stat check win percentages in a top-down approach, right?
Yeah.
I think GSC and Eldari are the clear winners there. I think Imperial Knights have remained the kind of gatekeeper army that they've been for multiple editions, where Imperial Knights will always do very well. They probably get stopped before that kind of final stage at an event as large as War Master, but they also prevent, because of their popularity, they prevent players who are not aware enough of Knights or have taken something that can play against Knights from getting to that next stage.
Mm.
So I expect Knights to do pretty well. I think, against popular belief, I don't really feel like Custodes are going to do particularly well at the War Master event. And I say that because a combination of, I think, terrain factors, the size of the event, and the fact that the War Master event is a lot of people gearing for teams. Mm. Teams by design builds extreme lists that are tech to do quite specific tasks. And many of those lists seem to be to kill custody equivalent models, be they Deathwing Terminators or Custodes or blah, blah, blah. And I think that if you're running a gamut of a 7-8 round event, I think statistically you will encounter one of those armies. Mm. So my money, as anyone who's a gambling man would be on Eldari and GSC being the premier. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe a Necron dude with some Ghost Arcs. I think it'd be hilarious.
I quite like Necrons, and I've painted my entire Necron army, but I wish I am waiting for Aldari and GSC to be pipped a little bit more, and then I think Necrons are definitely up there for sure. I think you raise a really interesting point, and I quite enjoy Knights on the WTC boards as well. I think the teleporting mysterious Guardian Knight with Towering is, I think a lot of people look at that and think, oh, Knights are so easy to play against, but I think when you actually play in real life against Knights, it's very easy to forget something like that. Intuitively, over the editions, Knights haven't had the ability to teleport, and then Towering is another layering rule on top of that, which can allow you to get line of sight and angles that you previously wouldn't have. So I think the teleporting Knight is actually really frustrating. I know I've forgotten about it on multiple games, which has been just been quite annoying. You do raise a good point, which is that the Warmasters is quite unique in that a lot of people play their team list or come to a team's event and play team style lists as well. So it's not, I guess you could say, it's not an exact replica of a singles event, so to speak, because there is that mix of skew in there, which is really interesting, because it'll be interesting to see how the singles-orientated only lists play against teams lists, for example, especially because I guess the element of that is that so many people, the vast majority of people, are traveling over into Belgium to play. So it's very unlikely that they'll be taking a singles orientated list along with, you know, the extra team models, so to speak, right? So they will teams orientated overall.
And you know, Dave, on the topic of kind of lists in general, I think that you know, one thing you've articulated a couple of times while we've been talking is that like, you know, you and I suppose our focuses, and perhaps that's due to availability of events or you know, like personal goals, etc., but the, you know, my focus being quite firmly on teams versus singles, it's interesting to hear, like, I guess, from somebody on the other side of that, because, you know, from my perspective, it's a symptom, not the disease itself. But, like, you know, for example, this the core idea that, you know, like, you're taking Eldari, for example, to this event is completely valid from the perspective of wanting to put your best foot forward, to use your own words. But I think, you know, from like a... every faction having its time in the sun, I think singles events are where dreams go to die because of these exact issues where, you know, the skill component, I suppose, of like, and mastering those tournaments, a big part of that comes down to a combination of access to models, list writing, and pre-event work.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I'm a huge fan of like intra-event skill expression.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I like intra-event skill expression just as a core concept, and the reason why I like teams, is because the pairings process from teams, I think, is the best example of that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And like we've already spent, I would argue, more than 24 hours like net talking about pairings as a team.
Yep.
And doing simulations and practice runs, and that part of tournament prep, that the pairings, is the reason I fell in love with teams,
mm-hmm.
Which is entirely absent, of course, from singles. But you have no control over what you play.
You do raise I would agree with you in that as well. I think singles does have some element of that. You know, I think if you look at the best singles players, they will be able to identify and predict what the other best singles players are taking. So there is sort of that intra metagame of a singles players tournament. Obviously, we have the UKTC over here. So, you know, if I were to go play a tournament, I'm looking at what XYZ player who might be coming to the tournament, what they've previously played. And there is that kind of pairings gambit. But you're completely correct in that there's a lot less in your control in terms of you can only play at the end of the day who gets put in front of you. And you've got no control on who, you know, who's going to get put in front of you. Only in the finals, when maybe you expect you're going to play against Manu Chimri in finals or something like that, right? So that's the only
control. Yeah, you know, I've had the fortunate opportunities over the WTC that was in Novi Sad in Serbia, and of course last year in Mechelen, I've had the fortunate ability to play a number of you know, quite skilled singles players, like, you know, Nick Nunavati. I've played Innes Wilson twice, mm-hmm. Jaime Paris,
mm-hmm.
Anthony Vanella, and it's been very eye-opening, I think, to approach even singles events and individual games, like with that kind of team's mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think from that list, I've dropped 4 battle points total. So yeah, it's been an interesting run.
If I may allow them, because this is a subject that comes up all the time, yeah. The subject comes up, the difference between teams made of singles players and teams of players. And I know you've invariably had this conversation as well. All your teams had this conversation. I think, you know, one of the stories of, if we can transition a little bit here, one of the stories of, I think, Team England this year are that they have a huge singles player roster, so to speak. You know, they have, at least from our perspective. So if the viewer or audience may not know this, if you play a lot in the UK here, you will recognize instantly every single name on Team England roster, maybe bar Chris Kinnear, as all players who have won super majors either consistently or, you know, won majors consistently, traveled abroad, played Vegas, top ITC, you know, 5 or whatever players in the world. You know, do you find that, I guess I've been struggling with this question as well, so maybe you can help me. Do you find that the teams that have the best skill expression players is more powerful than the teams that have more preparation, or where do you sit on that side of the fence of raw player skill versus team cohesion and preparation, so to speak?
Firmly with the latter. Yeah, I don't have to think about that for more than a second. And I say that because, you know, I think that, okay, I'm going to preface what I'm going to say with the fact that I'm obviously, you know, like the New Zealanders, I live in a small microcosm on the far butthole of the world.
Yep.
And part of that means that my exposure to 40K is largely my local community, mm-hmm. The dudes who play games on my pool table on a Friday afternoon and the barbecues on a Saturday morning. But jokes aside, I also deliberately, quite specifically, don't keep up to date with the trends from elsewhere. And the reason I do that is not because I desire willful ignorance, but because I think that one of the downsides of having this kind of like interconnected global 40K community is that we have a danger of becoming an echo chamber, right?
Like
we have this competitive idea, this competitive build, and it takes off, and then you kind of run the risk of people tech to fight that, and then you have 50% of the field versus 45% of the other rest of the field, and they're all just kind of countering each other. And then, you know, you have a select group of people who I think can come in with the remaining 5% of armies, mm-hmm. and no one knows how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of been the role that I see teams exacerbating, where if you have a team that gels well together and you have a pairings crew that understand the pairings and how pairings works, I think better than anyone else, which I'm very proud to say, I think that Australia does that. Our pairings team kicked it out of the park last year, and I'm very, very happy to have everyone involved in that process be involved again this year.
Mm-hmm.
And from my perspective, I think that trumps having a team of champions rather than a championship team.
Mm.
And, you know, I think last year, for example, like playing against England and Poland and USA for the Australian team,
mm-hmm.
That was kind of manifest, where there were some players with amazing resumes on all of those teams,
mm.
who've won super majors and whatnot. And then there's that Aussie dude who's never played at a tournament with more than 50 dudes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, kicked ass. And
yeah.
And I think the reason for that is that I also approach this as what you talked about before, you know, the people who've, like, all those names are recognizable. I think the danger of that is that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think for quite a lot of people, if you, David, if you play somebody at the singles event and, you know, your name is recognizable from your past, you know, tournament resume, I think there's a world, I think you'd agree with this, where people do perhaps play differently because they believe they're playing somebody of a very, very high caliber.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you go into that, the teams event, with the same attitude, you're actually really liable to make mistakes. You have to actually treat everyone as if they're good. Treat everyone as if they're high caliber.
Yes, I 100%. I could not agree any more than that. So, there's so many things to touch on there. I actually have a, I have an, I have objective markers that have gold signatures on it. So I get people to sign my objective markers. And one of the signatures I have the most, which I like the most, and I always place it in my deployment zone. It says "Victory is earned," and it's because I lost against Chase Chamber. I'm going to burn her his last time. I lost against Chase at LVO, and it was a typical game of overconfidence. You know, I'm going to smash this guy. You know, it's another round of playing some, low skill player at LVO or whatever like that. You know, and just got caught slipping in my jet lag and found out. And that's a great example. And me personally, I'm under no illusion that I feel like I'm the small fish in the big pond. You know, because you go over to Europe. You don't know who any of these players are or something, and then all of a sudden it's, some European player they've never heard of before, and he's like just as good, if not way better than you, and you're like, holy crap, okay, I need to, tighten the screws a little bit here more than anything.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a, so event success obviously suggests that you have the skills to win events, but just the act of winning an event in of itself doesn't mean you're actually a more skilled player than the player who came second, third, fourth, fifth, etc. Because your tournament run, the faction you're playing, heck, the table that you play on, depending on the format you're playing, all have a significant role in that. And I think that players who I would argue I what I'm going to say is that I feel like, from somebody again who lives in the butthole of the world, that the people who are prolific major or GT winners are also the people who are almost invariably prolific content producers. And but because of that, I think it exacerbates this echo chamber problem where you kind of have and I'm guilty of it too, where I have a small podcast here in Australia called The Normal Blokes, which I shamelessly plug and ask
Go
people to
for it.
listen to.
I'm going to plug
But also, like, when we get on that podcast and we talk about, like, oh, like we won XYZ event, of course the people who are winning events are producing content about themselves winning events, and
Yes.
so you kind of create this weird microcosm where what you think is good is distributed
Yes.
to many thousands of people. And
Yes.
it's just an interesting concept. When I go to the Northern Hemisphere to play at WTC, when I see, and I think the same thing is said for this year, is that if you look at the lists, you see a fair bit of Control C, Control V in a number of like powerful teams.
Yes.
Like you can see bleeding elements of like USA lists in other teams. Some of the lists are approaching being exactly the same, which is not a problem or a benefit that Team Australia has. I think all of our lists are very different.
Oh, man, there's so many things to touch on. On the point of exposure, I 100% agree. And the irony is that I don't know if this episode's going to come out before or after, but I said the exact same thing on the previous episode recorded last night, which is that, UK, USA players obviously, just tend naturally because of our exposure to get a lot more coverage, in air quotes coverage, right? And, at the end of the day, that I suspect very much that the skill difference is small at best between some of these teams, right? If you were to take a team England or like a team Spain, for example, right? I have absolutely zero doubt that Spain has an amazing roster of eight players that are extremely talented, simply because they may perhaps don't get any coverage in English or American, for lack of better words, 40K media coverage,
Yeah,
so to
no,
speak. You
very
know,
true.
it's you know, you I think it's good to go in with a humble mindset to think actually the skill difference here, which is completely different in singles, of course. In singles, you leverage the skill difference as much as possible, well, you try to at least. And but in here, I think the skill difference is a lot tighter, and you've then got preparation and team composition and pairings on top of that, which is are more elements that add layers of impact aside from skill differential, right? You know, you can only do the best with what you're served up, so to
Yeah,
speak, in
exactly.
a game. So if you're if you're making the wrong dish for the competition to begin with, then you've come out the wrong way. So I wholeheartedly agree with you. And it's an interesting phenomenon, which I don't know if we'll ever conquer that in Warhammer, isn't it? Now, I think your view of success is a very mature and good one. I wish I had that view when I was when I was first starting out. You know, I'm serious, because I really struggled with stuff like that. I thought the tournament was either I come first or it's a loss, right? And that's just such an unhealthy binary way of viewing success. Success is even too strong of a word sometimes. Just enjoyment, right? Or pride, I think, is probably a better way. Being proud of,
performing. I think that's fair. And, one of the things I love the most about 40K is how eclectic the 40K community is. I don't mean that insultingly. I mean that whole, I love it. I always talk about, the 2022 Team Australia has had, two doctors, a university lecturer, a social media manager, and then a dude who sells cabbages. It's such a eclectic group of people that bring a whole diverse array of personalities and backgrounds and interests that all come together to throw dice at each other and talk smack. And that's probably the thing for me that and when you ask about what success is, teams, 40K events, one of the things they do more than a singles event is you have this almost, I'm going to say cult-like, fanaticism that comes with going to an event like this. Us, for example, we've got the shirts, the polos, the jackets, the dice, the tape measures, the objectives, the lot. And we are all 13 of us. We're on the same flight over there. We are all meeting in Melbourne, in Australia, and all 13 of us are flying like a goddamn rugby team. And we are going from Brisbane to Abu Dhabi to Belgium. And we're traveling as a team. We're eating as a team. We're shitting as a team. We're honestly, everything we're doing is as a team. And it's so intense that the first time I went anywhere for a teams event, I knew this was what I wanted to do.
Yeah. It's this, that level of camaraderie is unparalleled.
Oh, it's so
even
great.
Because obviously we have main teams, so Team Ignite, for example, and we go to play singles events, right? And we replicate to that to some extent, but we're not as well. I didn't mean to virtual signal there. I'm invested in the success of my other teammates, but not to the same level, of course, as if we were all playing on the same team, so to speak, of course.
Well, David, you're probably not going to coach your teammate on how to beat yourself.
Yes, no, probably not. That's a good
point. Whereas I have spent a long time teaching everyone how to kill Lich Gar.
Yes.
because I'm invested in that.
Yes.
So I think that's the difference, right? I am truly 100% committed on the rest of my teammates kicking it out of the park.
If you don't mind, if we touch on the, we've got the pod stages. So we drew. What was your reaction when Team New Zealand and Australia were in the same pod?
So I'm going to rewind a little bit. About 2 weeks ago, there was a teams event in Newcastle in Australia called Steel City Showdown, where everyone from Team Australia attended that event, and we were able to sort of hide our armies, et cetera, because we wanted to do some productive practice. At that event, I was on the phone to Neil, one of the TOs, Jay, one of the head judges, and I clarified how the pod system worked. And he was like, we're going to have first seed, second seed, third seed, fourth seed. And I made the joke. I actually asked him, I said, what's New Zealand? I'm curious. And he's like, oh, there's a chance that you play in New Zealand. And I was like, okay, so you're telling me there's a chance I can spend $5,000, I can fly all the way to Europe, and the first game that I play is going to be against someone from New Zealand that is a 5-hour flight from where I live? And he's like, yes, that is a possibility. And lo and behold, this is where we are, round one, Australia versus New Zealand, which I think is an absolute laugh.
I think it's great as well. What I do want to touch on before is that, I can't help it, of course. So you're going to see the New Zealander come out me in a little bit here. You mentioned You said when you were all traveling on the aeroplane, all 13 of you were traveling like rugby team. Well, I hope it's not the Wallabies at the moment, mate, because we just smashed you 35-7.
Honestly, you did. I'm sincerely hoping that the maybe 0.001% of the Australians that give a rats about Warhammer are going to feel redeemed round one when Australia beats them again.
That was the only caveat from the previous episode where I said, I will genuinely concede that Australia are better than New Zealand at Warhammer. I've got no qualms with that.
Because you've got rugby.
We did just smash them last night. So, the Wallabies are looking terrible at the moment too, which is hopefully not going to be them. Hopefully that's not going to be the flip side of the coin of the Warhammer coin, so to speak. But it is interesting. I would love to get your thoughts on, New Zealand and Australia have a lot of history, and I think it's, to me, is a little bit like America, Canada in the brotherhood relationship. You know, we like to think that Australia are kind of our big brothers, and New Zealand likes to always punch above its weight in that sense. You know what I mean? And there's a lot of banter, and there's a lot of chipping and jibing and poking shoulders at one another. But I think one thing that's always been true is that, you know, we live at the bottom of the world together, and we've always got each other's backs, no matter how much we like to compete against one another. Is there sort of that sense in Warhammer as well? I guess because I've never, never travelled to play like the ANZ TC, which is a New Zealand Australia ANZAC team tournament, for example, right?
So yeah, I think there definitely is that kind of camaraderie. I think that especially for the New Zealand boys who I've met, like Alex Taus, for example, hung out with us quite a bit at Uprising Adelaide back in January. I think that there's a fair bit of camaraderie, and it's not toxic. I actually think it's quite wholesome in a way. There's almost a bit of a us and them mentality when we kind of say, oh, like we're from the Southern Hemisphere. We're coming up to fight all those Northerners. And it's you've really got to put on your really ochre bogan Australian accent, and you've got to be like, yeah, we're fighting them from up north. And, it's like, it's a bit of fun at the end of the day. And I think it kind of grows with that shit talk. Mm. One thing that I kind of wanted to say as well with the smack talk of WTC, one really weird phenomenon that I found last year was, so Australian and New Zealand 40K players do talk a fair bit of smack. We love banter and making fun of our own team especially.
Mm-hmm.
But especially the Australian team and a few key players who you'll meet, David, are particularly adept at having a loud voice and talking 110% garbage all of the time.
I love it. This is great.
One thing that I found really fascinating was when we went to WTC last time, the Europeans love it. They actually do. Like, it's incredible. It's like, honestly, I tell Matt Morozzoli to just shut up sometimes, like quite a bit, actually. Like, he does need to shut up. But then we go over there and Solly takes off his shoe and puts his foot on the table and goes, Typhus, suck my toes. And everyone loved it. The people are clapping and people are laughing. And I'm like, what is happening? What is going on here? It's like going into the Twilight Zone when, you're just being as obstructive and obstinate as humanly possible. The people you're annoying are loving it. It boggled the mind. I just didn't understand. But honestly, it kind of eggs us on a little bit. Like, obviously you go over there and you're like, oh yeah, like one thing you'll see, David, is I have a pair of tournament pants that I wear at tournament. I have these pink Hawaiian pants that I got given for my Bucks party, and I always wear them on the last day of tournaments because 40k players is a superstitious lot at baseline. I had about four or five players offer to talk to, like, they asked me, like, oh, do you live at Bondi? Or, like, all, like, the Australian stereotypes. It was just great.
That sounds good. I'm going to load up my best Australian insults and banter before doing then. I'm going to come fully loaded. It's on. There's going to be a few underarm balls at our game.
We deserve that. That's fair. But the ball has been tampered with, so...
Oh, that's good. I remember, so for context, Liam and I were chatting a couple of nights ago trying to organize the interview, and I said I wouldn't want to play anyone else apart from Australia. I think round one, maybe Canada, maybe have a chance of winning that one. And because I thought, who better than to have someone in our corner? And I thought, if there was any team that was going to be like, look, you guys need to, like, I think your lists or strength are like this, and I think you should lean into this, like, maybe, you know, oh, we've looked at Belgium and Portugal or at our pool, and, you know, I think we think these are kind of the weaknesses in their list, maybe try and go for that. And whether or not that happens or not, I would thought if there was any team that was going to give us some couple of hints or tweaks or something like that, I was like, you know, I'd rather have someone from the Southern Hemisphere be the C volunteer.
That's fair. That's pretty fair.
From a loser perspective.
The pod system's interesting, right? You know, I think it promotes an overall interesting, let's say, back end to the event. You know, it definitely makes the semifinals and quarterfinals and whatever to be quite exciting. But by the same token, it also can be a little bit artificial in the sense that you kind of avoid the potential of playing USA round one. Whereas, like, you know, Romania have to fight it out or whatever it is, it is a little bit artificial. The other thing that's weird, and I'm not sure if you agree with this, David, I'm assuming you do, is that I feel like in 10th edition more than 9th edition the mission changes how good a game is for you quite profoundly. I think the biggest thing last edition was, is it a hold two or is it a hold one mission, and that was kind of about it. With the exception of, like, maybe some of them are sticky objectives, that was kind of about it. But now, you know, like, for example, the round we're playing on, for Pete's sake, is the mission where at the end of the game there's only one objective.
Yes, the Alpha Omega.
And I mean, look, I've got 40 Necron Warriors that are OC3. I mean, you tell me what's good on that mission. I mean, like, you know, it for example, if you're playing that mission against another team, I think that quite profoundly changes your pairings. And so the pod system means that, and I felt like the WTC organizers picked, let's say, the more scandalous missions for the pod phase of the event, and kind of the more standard missions for the latter stage of the event.
Yeah, that makes sense. I completely agree with that. The missions seem to have a much larger impact. And I think that some missions, for example, like, doesn't actually matter if you hold your home field objective, I guess we're just jamming everything in the middle, and that's the mission, that's the objective that's going to be there at the end of the game, so I put most of my army over there, you know.
And that's it, right?
It'll take a genius to work this one out. So I agree that the missions seem to have impacted a lot. How have you guys, I'm not sure if you're aware, but we had a bit of a rant or a tirade about 10th edition when it first came out. How have you found 10th edition? Are you enjoying it? Would you have preferred WTC to be 9th or 10th edition? Is an interesting question.
Two parts to your question, sorry. The first part is, am I enjoying 10th edition? The answer is, yeah, I am, actually. I think that there are problems in the game, but I think that initially I was a bit down because I felt that the game's always had problems, but what I was worried about most was that I felt the skill expression elements of the game had been reduced. Quite specifically, like the combat phase, tri-pointing enemy models, tagging, things like that. Just the introduction of Big Guns Never Tire into the game, full stop, I felt was a mistake. And as I tested and played more of the game, I'm not as concerned about that as I once was. I think there still is quite a lot of skill expression because of the reduction in the prevalence of fallback, shoot, and charge, the change to fly, how movement works. There's actually still quite a lot of skill expression in the game. I love tactical cards. I'm sorry, I don't care if that's not a competitive thing. I love it so much.
Tactical edit.
I miss the old Maelstrom cards. And as soon as they brought back cards, and it's like, yes, like,
you're
like
the worst.
Honestly, I love it. I love it so much. And I have, like, honestly, I love it enough that has made me really like the game. And probably the biggest ticket item for me, and the reason why I actually do like 10th, is that I actually do feel like, jokes aside, that the OC mechanic is one of the best changes to come to the game I've ever encountered in the time I've been playing 40K. There's quite a lot of negatives this edition as well, but I think that the OC characteristic is very interactive. It's not hard to work out, And doing away with the whole concept of objective secured was such a good thing for the game. I think objective secured was a cancer. And I honestly think that we've cut it out, and this is a better version of that.
I see where you're coming from with the expansion of toughness, for example. The introduction of objective control has allowed for the stratification of that design space, really, hasn't it? It's a more open design space for where they can build stuff in. I think. Go for it.
Oh, sorry. There was a second part to your question. I'm sorry.
Would you rather WTC be 9th or 10th? I take it you'd rather it be 10th.
Yeah, so I'd rather it be 10th, but actually nothing to do with my enjoyment value. That's not fair. I would not enjoy going to prep for months for an event for me to then play rules that are invalid prior to the event.
Yeah.
And I understand that that attitude can be problematic because, of course, it reduces the time we can prep. And I fully understand that. But personally, I would not like to put the hundreds and hundreds of hours that I have put in and will continue to put in for WTC to then, like, for example, not be able to play local events for a while because all the local events will be playing 10th and not be able to test at teams events locally because they're all playing 10th and I'm playing 9th. I think it has more problems than benefits. So I'm glad we're playing 10th.
Fantastic. There we go. Glad we're playing 10th. You're right. There are some problems with it, but I think I've been enjoying 10th overall as well. However, the singles events, I think the single side of it is a little bit dire at the moment. I think that was to be expected. And the good part about teams is that teams invariably solves so many of the issues that singles has as well.
And
so
it's kind of what I said before. I feel like singles, again, I play singles events. I will play singles events. I'm playing a singles event with you in like a week's time. But I do think singles is where dreams go to die. Because if you are really enthusiastic about XYZ faction, the question at the moment you're asking yourself is not, can I do well with X faction? It's how many Wraith Knights can I buy if I sell my army? And it's a bit grim. I don't think that is, obviously I'm talking in wild hyperbole, and I fully understand that that's not the case for all singles events. I do understand that, but I also do have a point, right, where I think that the singles meta is obviously quite stacked at the top end with a very limited list of factions. And team solves that problem because everyone's going to have the same tools and you've got to try and solve those problems to the best of your ability. And the best thing in the world about teams is that if you lose 14-6 to an Eldari player and, you know, those 6 points that you get against the Eldar player who thought they were going to get 20, that can be your success. Your parameters for success are defined completely differently. And I think that's just so healthy psychologically. It's not all win-lose.
Yeah, I completely agree. Teams has been a big growing point for me. And hopefully, I'm sure it's going to be a growing point as well. I'm doing the singles. I'm doing the team event. I'm doing most likely be doing the pairings against, I guess, yourself or the team of coaches as well. And then I'll be doing the coaching as well. And then I'll be doing the play-in as well. So we're seeing just how multifaceted I can become in a certain sense here.
How much Red Bull do you drink?
Not enough. I'm quite a big coffee fan though. So we're going to be, we're hoping it'll be okay. So yeah, hopefully everything will be good.
It's a lot on your plate.
Yeah, I've got to, I'm doing some pairing simulations later today. One of the benefits I have is that in my main team, my singles team, is that we have 5 WTC players. It would have been 6, but 5 WTC players all from different nations. So some of them are not playing against each other, and some of them I messaged and said, hey, do you mind if I do some pairing simulations and I'll help you out? You know, you're playing against this team. I'll pretend to be them and we'll do pairing sims and stuff like that. So that's the best part about 40K. All brings us together.
I actually had an interesting question for you. I'm going to turn the onus back on you, David.
Of course.
So I heard from the Kiwi Birds that there are some people on the team you're playing for you've never met.
Yes, I've never met most of them. Yes, I've actually.
That feels profoundly wrong.
Yeah, there's about 20,000 kilometers that separates us, but that's yeah funny. Yeah, you're right. It's a bit of a unique situation, is it? It's funny because actually in Las Vegas, I think some of the New Zealand crew came to play, people like Finn Decker, for example, and whatnot,
yeah,
who you guys are more familiar with. I think they all went 4-1 as well, and I talked to them. I said, how come you guys didn't come play WTC? And they're like, oh, we didn't really know this year. And I thought, ah, well, you know, that's fine, that's fine, maybe the year after or something like that. So that's, for me, is a big goal, is to be able to just build up enough hype and success to bring another team another year, right? Like, that's the bar that kind of I think would be success for us. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the great part about Aussies and Kiwis is that, you know, they're all pretty easy to get along with, aren't they? So I have no doubt that we're going to be doing this. We've been chatting on, obviously, you know, we have a Discord for the team, and I've been kind of overseeing the list and stuff like that, and passing on as much information that I can glean from this side and from my teammates who are in teams and what like that, and doing scrims and stuff to try and make sure our lists are kind of competitive as possible. And I think that's, from a singles perspective, like, that's the most direct way you can contribute in a certain sense, right? Make sure you're turning up with the right tools. Make sure you've got at least competitive lists. And I think, as I talked about in a previous episode, the layers of complexity that I think a team like Team Australia can display is that it's one thing to just have 8 good, well-rounded lists, but in teams, if you do the matrix and the pairings and you work out that, you know, you've got space, design space for some lists to be skewed to a certain extent, I think that's really evident in the list that you guys have brought, for example, where you've incorporated the layers of complexity of pairings onto your list design rather than just simply having 8 good lists that you think will be all right to bring competitive games. Certainly recognize that, and I think I'm really excited to see how Australia do. You guys have got a very high bar to succeed, and I think in the previous episode I had Typhus on, and I asked him the question, if there was one team that was going to underperform, who would it be? And he said, well, you know, that would kind of have to be Australia to a certain degree, wouldn't it? They won best sporting, they won the singles, they won the teams. So, you know, there's only, you can either stay where you are, or it's only down from here. But I know that you guys are, I think you've got the capabilities to really drive it home. I've been really impressed hearing about just the levels of camaraderie and practice that you guys have been putting in. And I think one thing that's thematic that I've learned over the Contact Lost episodes interviewing captains is that the impact of preparation and teamwork is extraordinary. So I think that's really positive. I could see that Liam is nodding off to someone on the side there. So, Liam, if there's any final words, we're just hitting the hour mark. If there's any final words,
you're all good. My wife just came to make a coffee. She's working.
I'm so sorry.
No problem.
Anyway,
at all.
I'm really looking forward to every year at WTC. I meet a whole bunch of different new people. It's a great experience, and I'm an addict at this point, and I'm coming back for more. Really excited for it, and looking forward to meeting you in person.
Sounds great.
I'll shamelessly plug that at the end if that's cool. So we're a podcast called The Normal Blokes. We're Normal a podcast right. dedicated to improving the competitive 40K.
You're old blokes as well, aren't you?
And you can hear my wife working the coffee machine in the background. Really sorry about that. You can find us on Spotify, iTunes, YouTube, wherever you find your podcasts. We talk a lot of smack, and we're kind of focused on local events and the general attitude of improving the competitive 40K experience.
Awesome. I'm going to be tuning into some of that because I got a lot of painting to do because my army has just been assembled 2 days ago. So that's what I'm going to be listening to today then while I'm working from home. There we go. Liam Hackett, it's been an absolute pleasure. I've learned a lot, which is great because that's why I pretty much do this, is just to get better at 40K really. So I'm going to be stealing a lot of things. And thank you very much for coming on. It's been great. I'm going to be really enjoying seeing and meeting you guys and Team Australia in 1 week.
No worries, Dave. No worries. Thanks very much.
Have a good one, Liam.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the 40K Fireside Podcast. Vic and I hope you've enjoyed listening, and we greatly appreciate any feedback that you can provide after the show.